This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome back to another edition of the Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. It's me, Len Testa, and this is our show for the week of Schmurz Day, December 18th, 2023. On the show today, news and in listener questions, how much guacamole is too much? Then in our main segment, Jim pays tribute to Disney legend Dick Nunes. Let's get started by bringing in the man who says that you better watch out is fine, but you better not cry is a deal breaker. It's Mr. Jim Hill. Jim, how's it going?
Len, do you realize how many sad Christmas songs there are? There's a I'll be home for Christmas, if only in my dreams. And until then, we'll have to muddle through somehow. Christmas shoes, all right? You know, the folks at Kleenex have to be keeping their factory open 24-7 during the holiday season. I mean, all I have to do is see George Bailey reach into his coat pocket and find Zuzu's petals, and I'm a mess. You know, I just so you better not cry. Definitely a deal breaker come Christmas. You know, so
I mean, you got to remember there was a 20-year period where every Christmas song was written by someone who'd been through the Great Depression, World War II, or both.
Yeah. they were not a happy bunch, you know.
You know, so, just be happy you're alive.
There you
ho,
go.
Ho 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 ho. Fa la 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 la. There you go.
Okay.
Well, we should have been part of Tin Pan Alley, I swear.
That's it, exactly. So.
All right, Jim, let's do a quick shout out to subscribers over at patreon.com/Jim Hill Media. Thanks to new subscribers, Viglio Tech, Jack Haley Mom, Matt Straub, and Paul Sweetman, and longtime subscribers, Rob Bliss, Jessica Kravitz, Kirk Landry, and Megan Baumgartner. Jim, these are the Disney Imagineers training the Ursula animatronic at Journey of the Little Mermaid to grant guests wishes like Ariel's legs for her voice. They say that they've got Ursula to understand almost every conceivable guest wish, but the best offer they can make right now is an upgrade to preferred parking and a leftover 50th anniversary iridescent cupcake. So maybe don't ask for too much, folks. True story.
You know, to be honest with you.
Look, this is what I got, man.
That's exactly. To be honest, my wish is that the Ursula head actually stay on that animatronic. Have you seen the video? Where
I've seen the horror video of the animatronic with its head off. Yeah. Yeah, a lot going on there.
Cannot see that. So.
Speaking of Patreon, don't forget, folks, we're moving the show off of Bandcamp and onto Patreon, beginning with our show in 2 weeks, so January 1st, 2024. And we've just released our third video with Imagineer Jim Scholl, who helped build Disney MGM Studios. Sign up at patreon.com/Jim Hill Media, and don't forget to close down your Bandcamp subscription after that. All right, on to the news, which is sponsored by touringplans.com. Touring Plans can help you save time and money at theme parks like Walt Disney World. Check us out at touringplans.com. All right, sad to report, Jim, and you're going to talk about this in our main segment. Former Disney chairman Dick Nunes passed away last week. He was 91, and you're going to talk about this, like I said, in our main segment, but he was hired at Disneyland prior to the opening in 55.
He was?
And he worked for Disney nearly 50 years, helped develop Walt Disney World, then later Epcot, Disney MGM Studios, Tokyo Disneyland, and Disneyland Paris. Fantastic guy.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. Just an amazing story. Again, which we'll get to back half of today's show.
Right, right. Also, a friendly reminder to those of you who are traveling to a Disney park for the holidays, you'll still need a park reservation, and some of those dates are already full. So the Magic Kingdom is completely full on Christmas Day, December 25th. The studios is actually completely full tomorrow, December 19th.
Really?
You can still visit these parks after 2 p.m. without a reservation if you have a park hopping option. Yeah, it's after the 19th. Strange. Yeah, and it's weird because it's a Tuesday, but whatever. And speaking of the studios, Jim, you had a really fun story that came out of our gingerbread challenge about what Disney had to do scrambling-wise after the first ever Jollywood Nights at Hollywood Studios, right?
Yeah, yeah. I got this story from one of The event attendees for the Ginger Snap Challenge held earlier this month. This individual works for the entertainment team at Disney Parks Experience and Products and was one of the people who then had to put in 20-hour days after the first Jollywood Night, which debuted at Disney's Hollywood Studios on Saturday, November 12th, met with such miserable reviews. Now, where this gets interesting, Len, is that it turns out that Phil Holmes, the former VP in charge of Disney's Hollywood Studios, who retired from the company in August of 2020 after spending 50 years working at the Disney parks, he was there on the night that the very first Jollywood Nights was held. And as the managers at that theme park were tearing their hair out, watching in real time as the reputation of this brand new hard ticket was getting trashed online, Phil just laughed and said, "What you?
Oh, you think this is a disaster?"
No, that's it exactly. You know, he said, "So look, what you guys mounted tonight is 10 times better than the very first Mickey's Very Merry Christmas Party that we presented over the Magic Kingdom in '83. Likewise, the very first Flower and Garden at Epcot in '94." But the advantage that we had is that there was no social media. You know, people couldn't hop on their iPhones and immediately trash an event that they were at. You know, they could either swing by guest relations and lodge a complaint there or actually wait till they got home and then write a letter or make a phone call. And Phil then went on to say, look, you guys will figure this out and fix what needs to be fixed with Jollywood Nights. And by the time the second edition of this new seasonal hard ticket was presented at Disney's Hollywood Studios on November 18th, the resort's entertainment team had largely addressed most of the guest complaints from the first one. But again, I got to point out, this is largely because the entertainment team had put in 20-hour days between November 12th and the 18th to address all of these issues. So kudos to the folks who, you know, put in the time to make those fixes. And again, this explains that story you told about Chrissy as you guys are marching through the park. And it's like, Chrissy, this is lovely. And it's like,
oh my God, this is fantastic. Look at this lighting package. That wasn't there yesterday.
Here we go.
Because there are people working 20-hour days to make it right. Let me just say, Jim, injecting methamphetamine directly into your spine worked for John F. Kennedy. And if it worked for the president, it could certainly work for those cast members at Hollywood Studios who need to upgrade Jollywood Nights. So, you know, I'm just saying.
Just saying. Wow.
Okay. Also, I love that Phil is providing leadership there, because one of the sayings that I remember when I worked at American Express was from CEO Ken Chenault. Mm-hmm. And he said, one of the jobs of a leader is to define reality and to provide hope. So, you know, I can imagine Phil Holmes standing in the middle of Hollywood Studios while everything's going up in metaphorical flames and there are cast members running around like doing the Kermit flail. You know, it feels like, you know, takes a drag on a cigarette, like, you think this is bad? And then, you know, because it calms everybody down. It puts things in perspective,
it
right?
It does. It does.
Yeah. And then it tells everybody that things can be fixed. So that's good. That's an example of leadership. I really think that's true. Fantastic story. All right. All right, Jim, on to surveys. Catherine sent in a Disneyland food survey with a question I don't think we saw in the similar survey from Walt Disney World. And here's the question. Which of the following best describes how you and your travel party feel about eating during a trip to the Disneyland Resort? If none of them completely describes you, please pick the one that comes closest. And your four choices are, eating is a highlight of our trip. The second choice is, well, it's not the highlight. Eating is an important part of the, quote, Disney experience. Mm-hmm. The third choice is, there's so much to do at Disneyland that eating is fairly low on our priority list. And then the fourth choice is, eating is just a necessity to sustain us while we do the attractions. And the reason why I like this question, Jim, is because it addresses the difference in demographics in Disneyland, where most guests are locals, versus Walt Disney World, where most people are coming from out of town. So I suspect that if you compared these survey results from Disneyland and Walt Disney World, you'd get a majority of people choosing one of the first two options in World, and Disneyland would be different. What do you think?
It's what's fascinating about this question is, I would imagine what your go-tos are at the park really depend on when you first visited. I mean, if you're somebody who who went in, say, the early 60s, you know, Dole Whip, you know, because I had an amazing tiki room show. Whereas, you know, if you jump ahead to the late 60s, early 70s, it might be beignets and a mint julep in New Orleans Square. And then I want to say churros didn't come in till the 90s or thereabouts. So, the thing that your family does, or you and your friends and do every time you're at Disney, food wise would have to depend on what was the big thing when you came through the door.
Yeah. I mean, imagine somebody who hadn't been to Disneyland since like 1960 comes in today and sees, you know, churros and corn dogs and turkey legs and is like, America has succeeded by any measure that matters. You know, well, we won the Cold War and this is proof.
There you go. My day, we had, you know, warm water and popcorn. You know, it's like, hey.
We liked it.
There we go.
All right. And speaking of food choices, this listener question from Stincy Linson. Says this, I got the same Epcot survey about dining choices that you spoke about last week. When I was taking it, I got the vibe that they were trying to get a sense of what to do about sit-down restaurants in a theme park that has become so wholly about festival booths. How do they fill reservations when everyone spends all their time dining at festival booths? My responses made it clear that I only booked a table service restaurant because I needed to for Candlelight Processional, and I felt I had no choice, and I was pretty mad about that as Le Cellier was running an hour behind. Maybe there's no data to back that up and they're not having trouble filling tables at restaurants. That's just how I interpreted my survey. And this is a great point because, I mean, you got to think that Epcot's sit-down restaurants suffer every time that there's a festival, right?
Yeah. You know, and in fact, you know, what's kind of intriguing when you think about things like Space 220, where, face it, you can't really see or understand that show from the outside. You know, you have to have done the legwork, so to speak, the research. This is interesting. I have to say, you know, going forward and thinking about what happens when Communicore Hall opens and, you know, and we see the garden, so to speak, being used the way it's intended with the festival kitchens and the food carts coming online.
Even more choices in the front of the park, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think one data point that supports what Stancy Linson is saying is the fact that Restaurant Marrakesh has not reopened after 3 years in World Showcase. And it was always the last restaurant to fill up on busy days. Yeah. But so, you know, the popular restaurants, the beer gardens of the world, things like that, they're probably still doing fine. But it's the second or third tier choices where I think you're seeing a lot of people say, you know what, I'll just take my chances at the booths. And that's why Restaurant Marrakesh hasn't reopened.
Yeah. And is it's still a lounge, right? I mean, you know,
it's a sometimes open lounge. I was there last week. It wasn't open. Yeah. So,
okay.
This is from Nick via Patreon. Why did they stop making musicals at MGM? I grew up on Hunchback the Musical and Pocahontas the Musical, and I remember a Goosebumps show back there too. All right. So just for some context, Hunchback and the Spirit of Pocahontas were both staged at the Backlot Theater, I think, right?
Yep.
On New York Street. Pocahontas premiered in 1993, ran for 28 minutes, and lasted until 1996. Then it was replaced by Hunchback, which was a 30-minute show that ran until 2002. A couple of points. All stage shows are expensive to run because they've got a lot of talent and a lot of support staff. And big stage shows are even more expensive and an ongoing expense. Also, some of those stage facilities are massive and purpose-built. Like, I don't know, Jim, if you've looked at the footprint of Indiana Jones Epic Stunt Spectacularly.
Yeah.
It's about the size of the Star Tours facility and Backlot Express combined.
Yep.
So if you think about it, like, it requires a lot of very expensive talent, a lot of support staff, and takes up a lot of space. I think those are probably reasons 1, 2, and 3 why we're not getting more stage shows at the studios. What do you think?
Well, another factor here is to remember that when Pocahontas came out in, that was 96, I want to say, and then the following year, Hunchback came out, they didn't do the numbers that Lion King did. But, you know, again, Disney had assumed that, you know, Lion King had made so much money it blotted out the sun. So the next Disney right. animated musical was going to do just as well. And Pocahontas, I think, did half of what Lion King did at the box office. And then, you know, Hunchback the following year did two-thirds of what Pocahontas had done. And suddenly Disney got concerned about, hey, putting these big musicals in the park off of films that we thought would be hits, you know, may not be the smartest play. And they got cautious. So, you know, it's just kind of interesting to me. You look at something like Tangled or Frozen, and, you know, we got the Frozen sing-along show, but, you know, we never got our, you know, Tangled in the Park musical. Mind you, we did on the cruise ship, but, yeah, just kind of interesting that these sort of fell out of favor for a while, so.
Yeah, I mean, I think the number of facilities that are able to do really big stage shows like this is fixed. I don't think Disney's going to build many more. No. The fact that the Magic Kingdom didn't move forward with its theater on Main Street, I think, is evidence of this. So if a new show is going to go in, something's going to have to come out.
Nope, you're not wrong. You're not wrong.
All right, on to the next thing. And before I do the next one, I want to take a moment to thank whoever attended our talk at MIT in November and gave us a bag full of Marvel greeting cards. So whoever did that, thank you so much. It made our Christmas card list much easier to manage. And we really appreciate it. So thanks again. All right. And the reason why I mentioned the MIT thing is we actually got a listener email that we read at the MIT event, but we never did on the show. So we'll do it now. So a listener who we're going to keep anonymous recently submitted a right to know request to Disney Parks and Resorts asking for all of the data that Disney has on them. And specifically here, they're looking at park data. And the listener said that the first response from Disney was to send back a form with the very basics, like their email addresses they have registered, the annual pass they hold, online subscriptions, thing like Disney Plus and ESPN. But the listener knew that there was more information and wrote back to Disney saying, this doesn't include things like my annual pass use or other in-park activity. So I don't think this response conforms to the law, at least in California. Mm-hmm. And then they waited. Eventually, Disney sent them back 63 pages of information. And not only is it 63 pages, Jim, it's single-spaced in six-point font.
Holy cow.
But the information in here is kind of amazing. So one of the things that the listener points out is that Disney knows to the exact minute the fact that they ordered two sides of guacamole at Pecos Bill's Tall Tale Inn and Cafe for lunch, along with a Diet Coke and a side of yellow rice. And it got me thinking, like, I don't want my doctor to know this. I think a money-making opportunity here for Disney is to send emails to people and say something like this. Hey, I noticed you were a party of one and ate the entire cinnamon roll at Gaston's Tavern. What's it worth to you for us not to tell your doctor about this? If you subscribe to Disney Plus right now on a two-year subscription, we can make sure that this information stays just between the two of us. Click here if you agree. I don't know, Jim. I'm just saying everyone's looking for new revenue opportunities. We haven't really explored blackmail on Disney Parks experiences and resorts, have we?
Wow. Okay. Finally, take a way to use, you know, the Disney villains in branding. And it's like, you know.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh, my God. This would be perfect. Two sides of guacamole. Oh, my God. Amazing. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, Jim recaps the career of Disney legend Dick Nunes. We'll be right back.
The holidays are here, people, and if you're still struggling to come up with just the right way to show the loved ones in your life how much you really care, please allow me to direct your attention to the gift that's going to solve all your problems this holiday season, and that's StoryWorth. StoryWorth is that online service that helps you and your loved ones preserve precious memories and stories for years yet to come. It is a thoughtful and meaningful gift that connects you to those who matter most. And how does it do that, you ask? Well, every week, StoryWorth emails your relative or friend a thought-provoking question of your choice from their vast pool of possible options. Each unique prompt asks questions you've never thought to ask them before, like, who were your favorite professors at college, or what sports did you like most as a child? And after 1 year, StoryWorth will compile all your loved ones' stories, including photos, into a beautiful keepsake book that you'll then be able to share and revisit for generations yet to come. Now, my mom keeps the StoryWorth book that we got her out on display in her living room. And Nancy and I were just down visiting with her yesterday in Massachusetts. And when I cracked that thing open, I found myself rereading the story that my mom had shared about the first time she and my dad really connected, which, believe it or not, was when these two performed together in their Sunday school pageant. My dad played Joseph, my mom played Mary, and the role of baby Jesus was played by a 60-watt light bulb. These are the sorts of stories you can expect to hear from friends and family if you set them up with StoryWorth this holiday season. It is a thoughtful and personal gift from the heart that will preserve their memories for years yet to come. Go to StoryWorth.com/DisneyDish right now and save $10 on your first purchase. Again, that's StoryWorth.com/DisneyDish to save $10 on your first purchase. We thank them for sponsoring today's show.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, Jim, for this particular segment, and in honor of Dick Nunes, I've put on my formal business shorts.
Oh,
my business Bermuda shorts socks.
Yep. Yeah, Dick tried out some very interesting times during his stint at the company. And I what's kind of interesting, given that it's been almost a quarter of a century since this Disney legend left the company, he resigned as the chairman of Disney Parks and Resorts back in May of 99. By the way, 44 years to the day that he started at Disney.
Nice.
You know, a lot of the pieces that have been published over the past 24 hours about this storied 91-year-old were, you know, kind of a remember who this guy was. And yeah, you know, that it's hard to, you know, if you saw it, it's hard to unsee that picture of Dick in his Bermuda shorts.
He was pushing the frontiers of business attire, Jeff.
Well, he was, more to the point, because he was living and working in Central Florida at that time. And it's like, oh, dear Lord, I'm burning alive in this business suit.
I love it. I mean, how many of us would rather wear shorts to work? I mean, let's face
Absolutely. You know, but anyway, if you ever had dealings with Nunes, and I was lucky enough over the 45 years I've worked as an entertainment reporter to get a couple of sit-downs with the guy. You never forgot him because, in spite of him wearing those Bermuda shorts and having very cute knees, Dick Nunes was tough. Mind you, he was a Disney guy through and through. And given that Dick learned directly from Walt himself how the park should be run, there was no bigger true believer when it came to doing things the Disney way. But behind that constant smile and incredibly firm handshake, there was steel, and not to mention a distinct don't F with me attitude. what you'd expect from a guy who was born during the darkest days of the Depression. This was back in May of 1932, Cedarton, Georgia, a tiny little city, northwestern corner of the state. Nunes' family, hoping for a better life out west, traveled, as so many did in the mid-1930s, out to Southern California, where Dick then grew into a promising amateur athlete. Now, thanks to Marvel, Disney fans now have a basic understanding of the multiverse and how different paths in life could lead to different outcomes. And for a time there, it looked like Dick was destined for a career in professional sports. He got a football scholarship in 1951 to attend the University of Southern California. And this 182-pound defensive back seemed destined for great things until in Nunes' sophomore year at school, this would have been 1952, during a heated game with USC's hated rival, UCLA, Dick broke his neck. And that was it for Nunes' career in sports.
Yeah.
takes a year or so off to recover from the injury, and then graduates from USC with a Bachelor of Education in the spring of 55. But at that point, this then 23-year-old really doesn't know what he's going to do with his life. His dream of being a professional football player is over. But then one of his teammates at USC, a guy, a name you may be familiar with, Len, Ron Miller, offers Nunes a suggestion. It's like, look, you have a bachelor's in education. My father-in-law is building this thing out in the orange groves of Anaheim, and he needs to train a whole bunch of employees to come work at the place. And if you want a job for the summer while you sort things out, why not apply there? I'll put in a good word with him. And so that's how, May 26, 1955, Dick Nunes gets hired to work at Disneyland, and his very first job at the company is as a training assistant. He works under Van France, and he helps to get the first 600 folks who are hired to work at the happiest place on earth to get the hang of being happy Disneylanders. That's what they called them back
then. Disneylanders.
Not cast members, happy Disneylanders. And Nunes was definitely a happy Disneylander. He loved being part of the original team that pulled this family fun park up out of the ground. And so when the summer of 55 gave way to the fall, Dick put off the idea of using his bachelor in education to get a real job as a teacher and opted instead to see it, to stay at Disneyland and see what other opportunities presented themselves. But
So it's funny that he has a bachelor's in education, because I think I've talked about this very early on in the show, but I think I'm one of the very few people who actually uses their undergraduate degree in the field in which it was obtained. Like, nobody uses their college degree, right?
No,
in the field that they studied.
You are not wrong,
I remember talking to somebody at American Express who was very high up in leadership and technology, in the technologies group, and they had a PhD in anthropology. Yeah. And I was like, I don't see it. And then she's like, you don't see it? Look around. Look around at this organization. You don't see it? And I'm like, never mind. I got you.
I'll be digging down on those files right over there. So
exactly. Okay. Anyway. All right. So Nunes gets referred by Ron Miller.
Yep.
He starts off in training happy Disneylanders. All right. What happens then?
Well, he transfers out of training and finds a gig as an attraction supervisor at the park. And it's during this time, Len, he has his first real run-in with Walt. And as the story goes, Nunes was the area manager in Adventureland at the time. And after Walt went on the Jungle Cruise one Sunday afternoon and had a shorter than expected ride, Disney went out of his way to find the then 25-year-old Nunes and climbed up one side of him and down the other, complaining that he had just gotten a 4-minute long ride on an attraction that was supposed to be a 6-minute long experience. But Dick's like, but Walt, we have enormous crowds in the park today and a huge line here in Adventureland. And, that's why I told the skippers to speed it up a bit. So they could get back to the dock faster and then take the next boatload of guests out, on a cruise quicker and, thereby getting Adventureland attraction line down to a manageable size and lowering guests' overall wait time. And Walt just would not have it.
Yeah.
And he's like, look, he told Dick, look, these people paid for a 6-minute long jungle cruise and you're going to make sure that they get it. Don't worry about the line. Always give the guests the best possible show. That's what they got in line for in the first place. They heard the Jungle Cruise was a great show, and we always need to deliver on that expectation. And
you got to think, Jim, that if you were working the Jungle Cruise in the 1950s, you're basically living at Rick's American Cafe in Casablanca, because everything happened there. Oh my God! All right, so Walt talks to Dick. What happens next?
Well, because he learns this lesson firsthand by having Walt Disney yell at him.
Dick kind of remember that.
Dick Nunes never forgets it. And more to the point, Dick begins to borrow Walt's educational technique, which is to say, you come down hard on people, frighten them, so they then always do what you say. And so now, because Dick Nunes consistently delivers in whatever department he is placed in at Disneyland, he quickly rises to the ranks. And by 1961, Nunes is now director of park operations. I mean, he's only 29 years old. And he, more to the point, he's one of Walt's most loyal lieutenants. And I have to stress here, Len, that one of the main reasons that Disneyland ran so smoothly in the 1960s was because there were people in Anaheim who were deathly afraid of Dick Nunes. They knew he was one of Walt's favorites, and Dick Nunes too. You know, and to be honest, there were just a lot of folks who worked at the park who were afraid to cross the guy. Now, where this gets interesting is in December of 66, things got interesting for Dick for a while. There were a number of folks he had crossed at the park over the years who were now looking to settle some scores. But Nunes, again, who had played football, realized that sometimes the smartest play was to just step off the field for a while, you know. And so when things started to get hot in Anaheim, he thought this might be a nice time to change locations, and maybe go someplace a little hotter, like, say, Orlando. Dick becomes part of the team that originally develops Walt Disney World. And interestingly, when this project began to wobble in 1968, and you and I have talked about this, Len, there was that time where the company gave serious thought to not developing the whole 40 square miles, but just concentrating, you know, literally abandoned the idea of doing World Drive and putting the Magic Kingdom basically where the ESPN Wide World of Sports is right now, at the corner of 4 and 192. And
we talked about it, and it was like one of their original ideas, but imagine the long-term consequences of that.
Yeah.
We would not have what we had now.
No. And that's what Dick said, you know, to the effect that we need this 6 mile north-south road. We need to go all the way out to Bay Lake and dig Seven Seas Lagoon and all that. And what's interesting is that Roy O. Disney, Walt's brother, you know, noticed how passionate this kid was about this project. So when they really got in trouble, when it looked like, you know, that Disney World, you know, this was what, the fall of 1970, when suddenly U.S. Steel's like, oh, by the way, yeah, theme park will be ready, hotels will not. You know, and Disney then effectively fired U.S. Steel and took over construction and running those hotels. He needed somebody down in Florida to ride herd on this, to you know, again, forgive me for continuing to hammer on the football analogies here, but to get it over the goal line. And so he sent Nunes. And the thing of it was, Nunes was now 3,000 miles away from Burbank and Anaheim. And
there were no such thing as cell phones. So you could reasonably say, oh, I missed your phone call because I was out in the field.
There we go. And so Dick did what he needed to do to get this project completed. And there are all sorts of stories about, you know, the Dick basically scaring people into completing things. And what gets interesting is that, you know, when he does this, Nunes is hailed as a hero at the company. In fact, the very same year that Walt Disney World opens, Nunes is made executive vice president of both Walt Disney World and Disneyland.
Oh, wow. 1971. Okay. So he'd been working for the company 16 years. Mm-hmm. Now he's executive vice president of both parks.
Both parks. Wow. Okay. And Len, for the next 13 years, Dick is basically untouchable, especially since the parks are making money hand over fist during a time when the studios are genuinely struggling to make movies that connect with moviegoers of that era. So no one dares to tell Dick Nunes what to do. And so the projects that get built at the parks are ones largely that Dick is championing.
I mean, not for nothing, but classic Epcot came under his watch.
It did.
Just saying.
And what was kind of interesting is during this time, outside firms would reach out to Nunes and offer him the opportunity to come run their companies. And Dick would make sure that word always got back to Disney.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
You know, and so now, you know, and the board of directors was like, oh, God, don't do anything to upset Dick Nunes. We don't want him to leave. He's the reason that the parks are so financially successful. So, and Len, this is what Michael Eisner is told when he's installed as the company's CEO. In September of 1984.
Right. I don't know if you said this story on the air, but you told it to me once. It was basically like, congratulations, Michael. You're the new CEO. Do whatever Dick Nunes tells you.
Yeah.
When it comes to the parks.
Yeah. And for a time, Michael bought into that. He towed the line. But after about 5 years, during which Eisner bumped heads with Nunes a couple times over attractions for the parks, Michael decided he'd had enough. So 1991, Eisner promotes Nunes to chairman of Disney Parks and Resorts while making Judson Green, who is the company's CFO, the new president of attractions. And Dick set up with a plush set of offices in the Sun Bank building, which is still, by the way, across the street from Disney Springs.
Yep.
Given a full staff and no real responsibilities. Dick's job from here on in is largely ceremonial. Judson makes the day-to-day decisions about what goes on in the parks, whereas Dick, whenever it was time for Disney to present an oversized check to the United Way of Central Florida, he was the guy you called. And okay. But for a number of years, because Dick was nothing if not loyal to the Walt Disney Company. In fact, interesting gig that he wound up during this period. He was the guy who reviewed many of the history books that were being published about Disney. And he then had the final say-so on which stories got told. And Len, I know this for a fact because I worked with Van France on his Window on Main Street book back in the late 1980s.
Did you really?
Yeah.
How have we known each other for 15 years and I've not heard this before?
Well, it was published by this now defunct publisher up here in New Hampshire, Steve Fiat.
Squirrel Press.
Dang it!
Moose and Squirrel Amalgamated Inc.
There we go. Okay.
All right.
The original manuscript had dozens of great behind-the-scenes stories about how Disneyland really operated during the early days, but Dick wouldn't allow Van's book to be published unless some of the more colorful stories were removed. And what was interesting,
you wouldn't happen to have a copy of this manuscript, would you? Because I have a $20 bill burning a hole in my pocket, Jim.
I will go down into the basement and dig that out and send it along. Yes, I do have this book. But the interesting thing, Nunes was able to do this because, well, at the time, France was in charge of the Disney Alumni Association, which needed permission from the company to stage events and member meetups in the parks. And more to the point, a lot of the pictures that Van wanted to include in Windows of Main Street had been taken by official Disney photographers. So they were property of the company. And Dick just wouldn't allow Van to use those images without first removing a number of stories. But again, I'll get you a copy. You can look at it. Ooh, good stuff. Okay. We now jump ahead to April of 1994, which is when Disney company Frank Wells dies in a tragic helicopter crash. And for a lot of people at Disney, this is Michael was never the same after he lost Frank. Wells was often able to persuade Eisner not to go ahead with some of his kookier ideas. And with Frank now gone, the Disney company starts to wobble, of course. And by May of 99, Dick had seen and heard enough. He often talked about wanting to be a 50-year man at Disney. But given what Eisner was up to at the time, and Dick was really had a gift for reading the room. And, you know, he could look down the road and see that the whole Save Disney thing was coming.
And
decided, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. And so, honestly, there were a lot of people at the company who were taken aback by Nunes's sudden exit. But he already had a second act in mind. Again, remember we talked about that bachelor's in education he got at USC back in 55. Dick decides he's finally going to make use of that degree by joining forces with the University of Central Florida. And this is the part of the story that I think a lot of Disney fans don't know. Then the Florida governor Jeb Bush, reaches out to Dick. He's heard that, you know, he's not necessarily happy, you know, with what's going on at Disney. In fact, there was a joke at the time that the people who worked on the third floor of the Sunbank building, which was just below his, you know, Nunes's executive suite, they could, you know, that on quiet days, they could hear him groaning upstairs and pulling against his chains, you know. So Jeb reaches out to Dick and says, hey, look, we're getting ready to set up a board of trustees at each of the Florida State Universities. And, you know, we know that you're an enthusiastic Central Florida resident. And how would you feel about being a charter member of the board that we're looking to set up at the University of Central Florida? And that's the thing. Dick had, you know, again, remember, had come from Cedarton, Georgia, had become, you know, moved out to Southern California and really liked it there. I mean, surfed and the whole bit. But Central Florida was really a good fit for Nunes. So he happily took on this position and just threw himself into the board of trustees assignment. And what was interesting is because Nunes obviously had a lot of experience when it came to building things in Central Florida. The University of Central Florida underwent an astonishing building boom during his tenure at the school.
There was a while where it was the fastest growing school in the country.
Oh, God, yeah. And when you look at some of the stuff that came to be under Dick's watch, whether it was the 45,000-seat Bright House Network Stadium, not to mention the 10,000-seat UCF Arena. And by the way, both of those huge projects opened September of 2007.
And wow, same month.
Same
two huge construction projects.
Wow. Yep. And there you go. But here's the thing. The very next year, Dick has turned 76. And, you know, and I know it's the cliche that, you know, want to go spend time, you know, with my wife and family. But at this point, you know, again, he had time away from Disney. He'd accomplished a lot for the local community. And it's like, it's my time. It's my turn.
Yeah.
Now, mind you, he stays a proud Disney alumni, though it's been said that he didn't always recognize what the company had become, what with the acquisition of Pixar and Marvel and Lucasfilm and Fox. Yeah. And he had been pushed for years to write a memoir about his time at the Mouse House. And Nunes finally delivered last year, 2022, with the publication of Walt's Apprentice, Keeping the Disney Dream Alive. But that said, for those of us who have been trading Dick Nunes stories for years, this is a surprisingly toothless book, Len. You know,
pretty tame.
Well, this is the thing. Right up to the end, he's a loyal company man, and you know, the very best Dick Nunes stories. You know, the ones where through force of personality or sometimes just plain old brute force.
Force of personality or force.
There we go. He got his way. They were left out of this 320-page Disney Editions book, and. Look, a lot of Disney fans like to quote something Walt was supposed to have said, which is, if you can dream it, you can do it. And by the way, Walt never actually said that. I mean, what I mean is Marty Sklar wrote that phrase for Walt to say in an episode of The Wonderful World of Color TV show. But Walt never said that in day-to-day life. You know, it never came up in actual conversation. But more to the point, they miss the real point of that phrase. It's like, yeah, it's important to be able to dream things up. But you then have to have that iron will and that ability to turn something ephemeral into reality. Yep. And that's why a Walt Disney needs a Dick Nunes, you know, a guy who can actually do that, a tough guy who can take on seemingly impossible assignments, like turning 40 square miles of swampland in Central Florida into a vacation kingdom. And You only get that sort of stuff done if you've got a Dick Nunes in your corner, you know, who, because he played football so fiercely that he broke his own neck, Glenn, you know, he knew that the only way to victory was to fight and to claw for every single yard. And that's what Dick Nunes did every day. He was the toughest guy I have ever met, and loyal to a fault to the Disney company. But more to the point, also a real fun guy to talk to.
Really?
Yeah, I remember getting to sit down with him once. And, I figured the way in was to talk about projects that he had championed, that the company had not gone forward with. And so I brought up that New Orleans-themed hotel and restaurant that the company had once planned on building next to the Lily Bell in Lake Buena Vista, you know, where Disney Springs is today.
Oh, and I didn't know that was a Dick Nunes idea.
Oh, God, yeah. And it turns out, you got to remember that Dick was at Disneyland when they opened New Orleans Square and had to leave to go work on Walt Disney World. And so he'd always wanted that in Florida. Mm. So he was finally going to get that built. But he opened like a flower to me, and he was talking about, oh, yeah, we were going to do that. But, you know, what was really going to put that over the top is we were going to extend the monorail from Epcot over to the shopping village. And not only that, we were then going to create a people mover line that you could have gotten off the monorail, and then the people mover would have taken you not only to various stops within the shopping village, but it would also serviced Hotel Plaza. And even remember the Lake Buena Vista Country Club and the tree houses?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, that was
my sister actually stayed at the Treehouse Villas back when in its first incarnation. Yeah.
Yeah. And ironically enough, this was one of the very first things that when it was presented to Michael Eisner, it's like, yeah, we're not doing that. But anyway.
You know, it's funny that in talking to Jim Scholl, we realized that there was actually a proposal to extend the Skyliner to Disney Springs.
There was.
So that idea is still a good idea. It's still valid.
It is, you know, and maybe someday Bonnet Creek will let that happen. But anyway,
we'll call it the Dick Nunes line.
There we go.
All right.
Anyway, Mr. Test and I wish to express our heartfelt condolences to the friends and family of Dick Nunes, one genuinely tough guy. And honestly, folks, every time you enter the Magic Kingdom, you should thank him. Dick will definitely be missed.
Oh, fantastic story, Jim. Mm-hmm. All right, folks, that's going to do it for the show today. You can help support our show by subscribing over at patreon.com/JimHillMedia, where we're posting exclusive shows every week. On next week's show, we're going to talk about the many ways Disney has done A Christmas Carol, including a never-built attraction. You can find more of Jim at jimhillmedia.com and more of me, Len, at touringplans.com. One last thing, a GoFundMe has been set up in memory of our beloved producer, Aaron Adams, who passed away a couple weeks ago. You can find that at tinyurl.com/AaronZAdams. And donations there will go directly to Aaron's wife, Sabrina. And on that GoFundMe page, no donation required, you'll find a link to what I think is the best show Aaron ever did. It's our American Adventure script, which was a Bandcamp exclusive, so most of you have never heard it. It's really amazing, and Aaron plays the role of Will Rogers. That's over at tinyurl.com/AaronZAdams. We're produced spectacularly by Eric Hersey, who'll be defending his Golden Noodle Award with a mixture of mozzarella, Gruyere, and breadcrumbs, plus a secret pasta shape, at the 7th Annual Mac and Cheese Festival on Saturday, January 13th, 2024, on Sherman Avenue in beautiful downtown Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. While Eric's doing that, please go onto iTunes and rate our show and tell us what you'd like to hear next. For Jim, this is Len. We will see you on the next show.